At this time, I'd like to introduce our speaker for the evening, and that would be our very own Carrie C. from Harrison, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carrie.
You know, it's funny. I was writing a paper all day for school, so my brain is completely fried. And there's not enough caffeine in this world to make me think in a linear manner, so it's going to be an interesting talk tonight. Let me start off by saying that my sobriety date is September 6th, 1994. And obviously this is my home group, and I do have a sponsor. Her name is Debbie. And I think it's really important that when I talk, I let people know that, because I do have a sobriety date, I do have a home group, and I do have a sponsor that I use. And that's important because, when I came into AA, I came in when I, first AA meeting I ever went to, I was about 13 years old. And most people told me Al-Anon or Alateen was down the hall. And I was like, no. I'm in here with you old people. But I seriously began to come to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was about 16. I had already been in several institutions. I had had between 5 and 9 suicide attempts. I lost count after a while. I think that the highest possible estimate is 9. The lowest is 5, so somewhere in between. And so I had been institutionalized. Bless you. Was tired of living, and was a miserable bastard when I entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and actually sat down in a chair and began to listen. And the question is, well, how did I get that way? Alcoholism is not causal, and I love it when one of my favorite speakers named Chris R. says that, because my alcoholism had absolutely nothing to do with my environmental situations. I don't know why I have alcoholism. I've yet to have anybody to explain it in a way that makes sense to me. I mean, they can definitely explain the medical aspect. They can explain the biochemical aspect, but they can't explain the spiritual aspect. And see, for me, my spirituality is the thing that has been kicking my butt since I can remember. Now, I stopped drinking 10 years ago, but I can still get my butt kicked by my spirituality on a regular basis. So for me, as much as you can explain to me why I might have craving, I have yet to have a good explanation as to why, for whatever reason, my spirit seems to have these flaws in it. I love it that the big book says that when it talks about the fourth step, it says that we had character flaws, that there were flaws in our makeup, and I like that idea. I don't know how they got there. I don't know why I was the way I was, but I just know that I am. I had my first drink at 9. I started hitting rehabs when I was about 13. And I got really, really bad by the time I was 16. I drank like an alcoholic, and I never really go into drinking stories, and the main reason why I don't do that is, one, I have lots of funny ones, very interesting ones, very horrific ones. But if you're sitting here and you're an alcoholic, you know what an alcoholic drinks like. And the best way that I heard it described was simply in the big book. It says that we have a craving, which says, or an allergy, an abnormal reaction to alcohol, that when I put alcohol on my system, I want more. And that's it. And I used to, I love it in Bill's story. He talks about how how he woke up after a bender, and he felt like he felt this impending sense of calamity, that his nerves writhed. And I used to think that, like, oh, Bill had an anxiety problem. No, Bill was experiencing craving. Bill's body was saying, more now. And see, that's what happens to me when I drink. Once I put alcohol in my system, when something, usually an outside force, such as running out of money, you taking the booze away from me, passing out, or getting locked up, one of those outside forces stops my drinking or abbreviates or puts a little halt on it there, what happens to me is I become irritable, restless, and discontent. And I feel like there's writhing inside of me. I feel like I don't have any skin. And I don't know where you end and I begin. I just feel like like, I have no skin. There's nothing, you know, and I'm just a writhing set of nerves. And for me, alcohol took that away. Alcohol made it so that I didn't feel that anymore. You know, and so that's why I drank. And that's why I drank at a young age, and that's why I drank the way that I did for as long as I did, until an outside force that I'd like to think, I like to call my higher power, intervened in my life. You know, basically, I'll just tell you a little bit about the year before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's a very interesting year. Because one would have to wonder why at 16 would a bright young girl like myself enter Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason why was because I had been thrown out of my house by my mother to go live with my sister because I was dating drug dealers in Patterson, which never a really good thing when you're 15 years old. I mean, it's really not good. I mean, actually, I wasn't even 15. I think I was 14. No, actually, I was 13 when I started dating drug dealers. Let me fix that. So I was 13, and I used to date drug dealers in Patterson and Newark. And when you're that young, when I was that young, I was something of an idiot. Like, I thought they liked me. I thought that I was special. I thought that I was cool, that I had this older boyfriend who had this money. And, you know, they used to, I didn't know. Like, it wasn't until I got sober that I realized that I had been dating drug dealers. Because they used to tell me they sold firecrackers outside on the street corner. And I believed them. Like, I really thought they were selling firecrackers. Like, you know, so, but I thought I was so cool. Like, these older guys liked me. And, you know, I had been drinking, and I drank a lot with these guys, you know, and I partied a lot. And what began to happen was simply that, well, I didn't realize that women were something of a commodity sometimes. And so what began to happen was that I began to be put in some very difficult situations to get out of. I began to find myself in basements alone getting drunk or high with somebody and who was not my boyfriend, and he would become rather aggressive with me. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm Danny's girlfriend. You're not allowed to touch me like that. And he would just laugh at me, you know. And these things began to happen to me. And I found that my drinking kept putting me in these situations, my desire to get drunk, my desire. See, when you're 14 and 15 years old, you can't buy booze. So women, and it's just made my experience, I will find somebody to buy booze for me, and if that has to be an older man that I'm sleeping with, that's fine. So that's what I did. And so I had, you know, I was dating these guys, and I kept getting put in really, 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 really bad situations and coming out with very little of my mental health intact. And I began to become sicker and sicker. So my parents noticed this. They noticed that their bright young girl who was in ninth grade began to become withdrawn, was drinking all the time, would disappear in the middle of the night, would climb out her window, and would just go. And I also became very violent because, I don't know about you, but sometimes when you're being violated in certain ways, you take it out on those around you because I felt powerless. So I would come home, and I was a royal, royal witch to my family. And so I became violent, and I became nasty, and I became a very nasty drunk. So my mom, in her infinite wisdom, she brought me to Carrier. And this is funny, because this wasn't the first time I had, you know, been away. But I managed to talk my way out of getting getting into Carrier. Like, I explained to them that I was okay, that I was just having a hard time, that, you know, I was adjusting to being a young woman, and I was learning about my menstrual cycle, and that my drinking and my erratic behavior had to do with that. And for whatever reason, the intake counselor was a moron because they let me go home. And my mom was like, no, no, so you talked your way out of that one, sweetie, but you're not talking your way out of another one. Oh, and by the way, I was like, my boyfriend broke up with me, and I'm very depressed. So I pulled out every stop that a manipulative little girl like myself would, you know, pull out everything. And I talked my way out of going into another hospital, and my mom was like, well, no. You know, see, we're going to bring you up to Pennsylvania to live with your sister. And my sister lived in the Poconos. And this is not the Poconos of now. This is the Poconos of 15 years ago. What, trees? And that's it. No, you know, trees. No public transportation. No stores nearby. No quick checks, dude. Trees. So I'm in the middle of the woods with no license, no money, with my older sister and her four children, and no access to alcohol, except for the alcohol that was hers that I did drink within the first couple weeks of, and she wasn't an alcoholic. She didn't get it. Like, she didn't have a lot of alcohol around. One day, a couple years ago, I was driving down to Virginia with my sister, and she was like, you know, is this, you know, aren't you done with Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, you've been doing this for like 8 years now. She's like, you know, aren't you done? And I'm like, wasn't it a phase? And I'm like, and you know, she's funny because she's a nurse, and she's like, she's pulling out all like the psychological things, and you know, you've been into counseling and this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, well, Maury, this my sister's name is Maureen, and I said, well, Maury, what happens to you when you drink? And she's like, well, I have a glass of wine and I get kind of tired. And I'm like, Maury, one for one, I don't bother with glasses because they're a waste of time. A paper bag and a bottle is good for me. Two, wine, why bother when I can drink Jack Daniels? It does the job quicker. Three, one, what would be the point of that? I mean, I don't think that in my drinking I ever considered drinking one. And I think the main reason why is because I don't, unless I was drinking out of a 7-Eleven Big Gulp, I don't think I drank out of a cup. You know, just the idea of having a wine glass in my hand and pouring it out, or like even measuring, like, you know, I've seen people like in the movies, and this is something I never did, when they say, you know, can I have a finger of gin? What the hell is a finger of gin? What? You know, like, give me like a big fat glass, pour it in, and let me guzzle it down with a straw, and I'm good. You know, this is the way that I drank. This is the way that I related to alcohol. This is what we call the alcoholic insanity. You know, the idea that I think differently about alcohol than the average person. And after I explained that to her, she said, it's probably a good thing that you're doing that Alcoholics Anonymous thing. You know, but yeah, so I got sent to live with this sister, the teetotaler, the one who just didn't get it. You know, and I have, I'm one of five kids, and my parents, the poor souls that they are, I mean, my parents are not alcoholics. They're wonderful people. They got dealt a really, really bad hand. They had five kids. Four of us have had some sort of dependency, some sort of chemical dependency. I'm not going to tell you that my brothers and sisters are alcoholics and addicts. Some of them have graced the doors of this fellowship. But I could tell you that we all at some point or another had lost control of our consumption of alcohol and or drugs. So, with that said, my poor parents, I'm the youngest, so they knew what to do with me by the time I started to do my thing, which I was pissed at. Like, that came up on inventory. I mean, for years, I was like, but John, you know, my brother John did heroin for 10 years. You didn't send him away. Like, why did I have to go to rehab? Why did you mess with my drinking? Why did you kick me out of the house? Why did I get sent to the woods? Why? I mean, I didn't do it half as long as John. You know, I didn't get that. I thought she was mean to me. I thought they singled me out. You know, and, you know, obviously my sponsor said, you know, you'd be dead if she didn't do that for you, care? And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, they didn't single me out. They cared enough to kick my butt. So anyway, so my parents kicked my butt and sent me up to Pennsylvania to live with my sister. And I lived there for about a year and a half. And I couldn't drink the way that I had been drinking before I went. And I also had all kinds of psychological damage because of the things that I had been doing before I left. And so I spent about a year in my room with bottles when I can get them, pills when I could get them, and I slept and I hid, and I was terrified of going out of the house. I would walk in the night, you know, miles to get booze, but I wouldn't talk to anybody. And in that year, my aunt died. And my aunt was very important to me because while I was growing up, you know, my brothers and sisters are all a lot older than me. I was sort of an accident. Actually, I was what my mom thought was early menopause. My mom was 40 when she had me. My dad was like 43 or 44. So my brothers and sisters are all a lot older than me. So when I was growing up, like really, really young, they were going through their issues. So we had a very, very hectic, very crazy household. I mean, it wasn't, you know, a cop car, a fist fight, somebody going to the hospital, somebody ODing. I can remember being woken up like in the middle of the night because my sister was choking on her vomit because she passed out you know, she came home drunk. She passed out in her clothes. And I learned, by the way, if I'm going to pass out, try to pitch forward after that. because she would fall asleep. And this is not a rare occasion that my sister would fall asleep. She'd vomit and start to choke on it. And my mom would have to drag her out of bed and turn her over and try to say, you know, I believe that, you know, she tried, you know, she had to try to save her life because she was choking. She was dying. So ODs, choking on your vomit, police cars, blood, these were things that were pretty status quo in the Cosgrove household. And mind you, we're the only Cosgroves that did that. We have actually, what's hilarious is that my sisters just came back from Ireland, and almost every other branch of the Cosgrove family is very successful. I have an uncle who's, I believe, is a dean at Fordham University at the law school. I have lots of lawyers and doctors and professionals, and, you know, our branch of the Cosgroves became the professional drug addicts and alcoholics. We became professional criminals, professional junkies, and professional drunks, myself included. My parents were typical middle class. I grew up in Bloomfield. My dad drove a truck. My mother was a secretary. I never wanted for anything. I never had any material deprivation. I had security. I grew up Irish Catholic. I had religion. I went to church every Sunday. I went to church once during the week. I confessed every 2 weeks. Very religious family. One would think with all of that structure in place, like how could little old me get out of control? And that's why I'm telling you that it's not environmental. You know, it can't be, because I had so many things going for me, yet I managed to become so very sick very quickly. With all this going on, I was explaining, I had this aunt who was my mom's spinster sister. And she was the one who, when my brother would be beating the hell out of my dad, or my brother and sister would be fighting, or when the cops were there, or when some of the horrors that I were going on in my household at the time were going on, my aunt would be the one to pull me out. She would be the one to say, "Carrie, let's go for a walk." She would, "Carrie, let's go to the store." "Carrie, let's go to the park." You know, my parents were dealing with three raging alcoholics and drug addicts or whatever they were. And they didn't really have a lot of time for me, and my aunt was the one who did. And so here I am, I get in trouble, I get kicked out of the house, I get into a fight with my mother where I actually hit her, and I get banished to Pennsylvania, and my aunt dies within 4 to 5 months of me leaving, and I never got to say goodbye. And so I'm locked in my room with limited access to alcohol and just me. Can you imagine what that year was like? Oh, my God. That's where all the suicide attempts happened, except for one. Only one happened in New Jersey. I tried to die on a systematic basis. I mean, I tried everything I possibly could. You know, I carve up my ankles and my wrists trying to get the vein. You know, I learned the right way to slice your wrist, by the way, because you can't do it this way if you're going to cut deep enough. You have to do your ankle and your wrist. But see, I tried so hard to kill myself that I learned that through trial and error. And my sister, thank God she's a nurse, had to save my life more than once. So, which I have since made amends for, by the way, to her and her children. So this was the year before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. So although I was locked, because I was locked up in the woods, I actually did well in school for once in my life, because I had nowhere to go. You know, like, if you're in the woods and you got nowhere to go and you're bored, you got to go to school. Like, there's nothing else to do. You can, like, light a fire in the backyard and hang out by it. But, like, you know, if you actually get tired of watching cartoons, and my sister didn't have cable, so there was no way I was staying home. You know, I had watched all the videos, like, 1,000 times. I mean, I just had to get out of the house. So I actually showed up to school, and the amazing thing is I actually have a brain. So when I'm present in school, regardless of whether or not I do my homework, I actually do very well. So I managed to do very well that year. And after my last suicide attempt was that summer, the summer that I turned 16, my parents were like, "Okay, well, we'll take you back, and you can come live with us again." And I got into this really good private school. And it's sort of notorious. It's called Mount St. Dominic's, but it's known as Mount St. Mattress. And so I got into this private school, and I did, you know, I thought to myself, I said, okay, let's see, let's take stock of my life. I can't die, because that doesn't seem to be working out for me. Drinking don't seem to be that good. Men suck. My family doesn't want me at home, but then they're afraid that I'm going to kill myself and actually succeed, so they want me there so they can watch me. I've been in more psych wards than I can count, including not the cushy ones with Carrier, like my favorite. I love Carrier because I got pool, horseback riding, I can make lots of crafts. I came home with all kinds of slippers and belts and, you know. But so I ended up also in like some of the nice hospital psych wards, which are never fun. Yeah, because, you know, I've woken up on a psych ward after a drinking bout and a suicide attempt or depends if I got, sometimes I get very violent when drinking and I'd have to be subdued and brought to the ward. And I'd wake up with people who were, you know, they'd go down on the street and they'd get all the homeless people and they would bring them into the hospital. And I'd be sitting there in my little scrubs and my slippers, you know, shaking off the drinking, which I thought, like, when I wake up in the morning and I'd be like a mess and I'd want to vomit in my head and on my head, my hands would shake. I swore, I'm like, it's this stress. My life is so damn stressful. I mean, I got to get up. I got to go to school. It must be anxiety. Like, I never put it together that, like, my drinking had something to do with that. So I'd wake up in these psych wards that, you know, that were for the indigent, you know, and, you know, because they had nowhere else to put me. And so I got sent back to New Jersey, and I said, okay, so this is what's been going on in my life. Why don't you turn a new leaf? Okay, what if you're a good little girl? You know, like, what if you put on your little Catholic schoolgirl uniform and you go to school and you you don't dye your hair blue anymore and you pretend to be normal and you pretend that you're good? Maybe, like, this will work. And so I lasted about a month and a half before I started getting drunk again. I had picked up a boyfriend. And I picked up this boyfriend who didn't know that I had this drinking problem, had no idea what I had been doing for the past 3 years. And so I picked him up, loved him to death, then broke up with him because he was going to dump me because he find out what a slappy, horrible drunk I was. And then went to school, set a fire, and then ate a bottle of pills. And then there went my next trip to Fair Oaks. And when I was in Fair Oaks, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And this is what I'm talking about. This is why at 16 that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because you can't live like I lived. You can't drink the way I drank. You can't feel the way that I feel and survive. You just can't do it. So I ended up going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I liked what they said. You know, some young people came in, and they were all bright, and they smiled, and, you know, they didn't smell, they washed their hair. You know, I had the same, you know, zip hooded jacket that I had worn for like 3 years with, like, you know, anarchy symbols on it, you know, that, like, it had holes and safety pins, and they made me take the safety pins out, by the way, in the hospital, so it was like gaping holes, and there was this bright, beautiful young people, you know, and I'm like, ooh, it's a hey thing. Maybe, you know, then I could be a good girl. And so when I got out, I started going to meetings. And the one thing that I wasn't all that keen on was, see, I believe that my alcoholism had to do with my experiences. I thought it had to do with my childhood. I thought it had to do with because I had a heroin addict brother, or that my parents didn't love me enough, or I didn't get enough attention. So I spent all my time blaming everybody else around me for why I was so screwed up that I wasn't able to take responsibility for who I was. And so when I came to AA, I didn't hear what was being said. I heard, I'm an alcoholic, so it's okay. I could just do what I want because I'm sick. So I did, and I ended up drinking. And, you know, and I found a lot of young people who were like me, and we went out drinking together. I found that, you know, you can find people to relapse with in Alcoholics Anonymous and tear up the town. And I did that. I was one of those people, like, you know, I love when my sponsees will talk about the people who, like, they call them hooks, you know, who will come in and they're, like, looking for somebody to relapse with, and that was me. I would do that. I would look for somebody who was on the verge of relapse, and I'd be like, come on, come drink with me. We'll come back tomorrow. And obviously, it didn't go that well for me. So then I ended up getting arrested by my mother had me arrested. I fought six Bluefield police officers in my parents' living room one day after I had run away and I had come home to steal from her. And she said, you either go to rehab again or you can't come back. So then I broke in a second time. Or tried to, I should say. She's really smart. My mother's a very smart woman. And so she had me arrested by six police officers, and I fought them. I mean, I kicked them in the balls. I bit them. I was feral. And so, they handcuffed me, put me in the back of the car, and brought me to the police station. And I actually got a police escort to my last rehab. They walked me up to the goddamn ward. There was no, just drop you off at the door. It was, I went into the intake room like this, okay? And I was happy to get the handcuffs off, And, because I have the little room, I don't know if anybody's gone to rehab, but you have a little room where you have to go talk and tell them about, why you're coming here. And, I ended up on, fire escape, suicide, and violence precaution with 5-minute checks, because that's how sick I was, I couldn't pee alone, So I ended up, and after I came out of there, I ended up going back to AA. And I actually stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous for about a year and a half. But the one thing I didn't do was the steps. I got a boyfriend. I got a coffee commitment. I went to a lot of dances. I did 90 dances in 90 days. I didn't touch the steps. My higher power was a rock. It was. I had this, beautiful amethyst rock. My first sponsor gave this to me. It was a beautiful amethyst rock. And I said, I'm not really doing this God thing. In fact, I hate God because God did this to me. God made my life suck. God's the one who gave me this horrible deck. And now I can't drink and I got to go to AA with you people. I hate God with the fire of 1,000 suns, man. I hate God. And she's like, well, do you like rocks? I'm like, they could be pretty. So she gave me a rock for my celebration. She gave me a rock. It was beautiful, too, until I sold it for drugs. I did. So I had this rock. My higher power is a rock. So how long do you think I could stay sober doing that? I mean, I'm actually surprised that I stayed sober as long as I did. If you think about it, about a year and a half, I stayed sober like that? Oh, my God, but I did some damage. So I relapsed because I turned back to what I do all the time, which is use men. I ended up finding a... What I call my mark, and I found an older guy who would take care of me, and I ran away from home, and I lived in his house. I was 17 years old, so it was very illegal. I put him in some very, very difficult circumstances. I took his money and pretty much used him until he got tired of me and threw me out. And then I had nowhere to go, and I met my husband. And I met him. He was 3 days off a drunk. And I had about a year and a half, so I was clean when I was doing this. That's what I tell you, the spirituality will kick the hell out of you. It'll kick the hell out of me. And I do the sickest things when I'm drinking, when I'm sober than when I'm drinking. I'm sicker sober if I don't treat my spirituality. So so I met my husband. We relapsed together. And 4 months later, I came back to AA. And that is my experience with alcohol. And that's why I'm here. That's why I got sober at 18. Because alcohol kicked the hell out of me. And the thing is that, and this is my experience, the night that I relapsed, I hadn't drank in a year and a half, and I was going out to get a drink. And I said, I'm going to come back tomorrow. Time doesn't mean everything. Everybody says that if you get up early in the morning, then you're sober the longest, right? So I'll just get up really early the next day, and I'll go to AA, because only this 24 counts. And that was my intention when I went out to drink, and I drank for 4 months. Because I don't get done with alcohol. Alcohol gets done with me. I don't get to choose when I stop drinking. And what happened to me is I lost everything that I had. I lost my job. I lost my apartment. I quit high school. And I ended up living in other people's basements and carrying my clothes around in a garbage bag. And I left my garbage bags, many of them, over other people's houses, and I would go back to take a shower and take my clothes and then leave. And I can't, that was the way I lived. And I crawled out of that basement on September 6th. And the night before I had gone to an AA meeting. I don't tell this story often, but I'll tell you guys it. I hadn't gone to an AA meeting. I had gone to a park, Town Hall Park in Kearney, which is right next to an AA meeting on a Monday night at 7 o'clock. And I'd gone there to meet my ride to go into the city. I had a bottle of Bacardi in the back my back pocket. Because, you know, Bacardi bottles fit really good back there. I used to carry one in my back pocket. I had a bottle of Bacardi in my back pocket, and I had a ride to the city and $200. And I managed to, like, I said, I'll meet you at Town Hall Park, not thinking that there was an AA meeting there at 7 o'clock that night. And so I'm at Town Hall Park, and there's all these AA people standing outside that I knew because I had been in AA. And one of these guys, his name is Billy, pulled me aside, and he said, you know, you can come downstairs, you know. We're not going to judge you. You know, you can come down here anytime. You know that. We'll take you back. And I was like, Billy, listen, I got $200. I got a bottle of booze and a ride to the city. Do you really think I'm going to come down there tonight? And the next day I woke up and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Had that man not said that to me that night, I don't know if I would have come back. Because I think I would have been so afraid of what I thought you people were thinking about me. I don't think I could have, I don't think I would have had the courage to come back. So I did. God came in, smacked me upside the head, and I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's my first step. You know, the utter unmanageability, the powerlessness over alcohol, the craving, the mental obsession, the insanity of alcoholism, the idea that I'll just drink one night and it'll be okay, or that I can manage my life, I'll just give AA my drinking, or that God doesn't have to have anything to do with my getting better because I don't like God anyway and he doesn't like me. You know, that's what I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous when I came back. And I was very lucky, you know, because I did meet people who helped me with the steps. They sat down with me with the big book. They explained to me what my problem was. They explained to me. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't know. I said I was an alcoholic for years. I didn't know what the disease meant. I didn't have the disease concept. I didn't understand the elements of alcoholic addiction. I didn't get it. I just knew that I drank and bad things happened. That was my explanation as to why I came into AA. I had no idea that I had this subtle insanity. I had no idea that I had this mental, that I had this craving. And I had no idea that I had this spiritual malady that had been kicking the hell out of me my whole life. So, you know, when somebody explained that to me for the first time, I was like, so that's what's wrong with me. You know, Billy, buddy, when you're talking about that, you know, it's like, so that's what's wrong with me. The absolute relief that I'm not defective, that I have something that I can put my finger on and say, that's what's wrong with me. You know, It was such a relief, but I didn't hear about that until I was 2 years sober. I had 2 years of alcoholic insanity, dry, stark raving sober, and it was extraordinarily painful. So when I did hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I did hear about the 12 steps, I tore into them like there was no end, because I was desperate. You know, when Bill talks about the desperation of the drowning man, he's not kidding. So, you know, it's funny because I like to talk about the second step, but, you know, I feel like when I talk about the first step, I feel like I'm right into third and fourth. And the reason why is because when I decided that I was going to do this whole 12-step thing, I didn't really understand the whole concept that there was going to be a God that was going to give me power and direction. I didn't understand that lack of power is my dilemma. I just knew that I was broken and there was something that could possibly fix me. Please do it now before I die. You know, and it was after I had completed the steps that I really understood the implication of the leap of faith that I took. And it wasn't a leap of faith of virtue, it was a leap of faith of pain, of absolute desperation and pain, you know. And so I love it. Like, the second step has so many beautiful things that, for me, only really made sense after I had experienced them. And that's why I like to call the second step as the God experiment. Because really all it is saying, all right, God, I can't, you can. My ideas did not work. The God idea did, you know. And then afterwards, I was able to have, once I had that experience with God, once I had the healing that I had with the 12 steps, I can go back and say, you know what, God? You did really good for me with all this stuff. You can have it all. Just take it all. Just take it, please, because I can't do it, you know. But for me, it wasn't like I walked into the steps and said, okay, God, you can take all the care. You know, you can take my alcoholism. You can take my relationships with men. You can take my relationship with my children. You can take my financial relationships. Take my relationships with strangers and everybody else around me and my family. And just take it all, God, because I just want to be better. I was like, that wasn't how it worked for me. It was, for me, it was a process of having that experience, feeling that awakening and saying, if this is good, then more is better. And I love that, you know, sometimes I hear in meetings that people say that this is a disease of more. Well, it is, because I have the disease of more when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, for me, and this is just for me, I'm a result-oriented gal, you know. And Jay pointed out something to me in A Vision for You that I loved. He talked about, there's this line that says that, talks about 12-step work, and it says that when we first do 12-step work, I'm paraphrasing, of course, when we first do 12-step work, you know, we do it because we want to stay sober. And then after a while, it's not because we want to stay sober, because we like what we get from it. We like the spiritual release, and we like the, you know, like there's this feeling that happens within you when you carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, when you're not thinking about yourself for 5 minutes, you know, and that we, after a certain point, we get hooked on that. I did. I got hooked on that. And I am hooked on it right now. I am hooked on helping others, because for one, you know, for that 5 minutes that I'm talking to you, I'm not thinking about me. And that was part of my problem. I admitted that there was the possibility that there was a God out there that didn't hate me. That was about as far as I was willing to go when it comes to the second step. And I was willing to see what the steps had to offer. And that was as far as I went. You know, and later on, I got much deeper. And then, you know, I love the third step prayer. You know, I made a decision to turn my, you know, it's the third step is obviously I made a decision to turn my will and my life under the care of God as I understand him. But the third step prayer is absolutely beautiful. And if you break it down, if you really look at that prayer, it's amazing. You know, it says, God, I ask that you build with me and do with me as thou will. So I'm asking God to build with me and do with me. I'm not saying God fix me right now, because right now at the third step, I don't even know what's broken. I know I'm broken, but I don't really know what. And at this point, I'm just saying, God, build with me. So I'm saying, God, okay, I've been drinking, and I've been acting out in self, and I'm outside the realm of your creation. I haven't been contributing to your world one bit. So now I'm asking you to put me in play. Put me on the chessboard, God. Build with me and do with me as thou will. And then I'm saying, relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. I'm not asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self so I feel better. I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self so that I can serve God. So I can do your will. You know, take away my difficulties. So take away my difficulties. Take away my sticking points. That victory over them will bear witness to those I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. So victory over my difficulties has nothing to do with my own personal comfort. It has to do with demonstrating the power of God in my life. And that's why I'm telling you that, and this is, I say this all the time, is that when I am helping you, I am not thinking about me. For like 5 minutes of my life, it's not about me. When I sit down and I just play cards with my daughter and I'm just giving her the teeniest bit of attention, it's not about me. I'm not in there. And for me, for an alcoholic like myself, I need to not be thinking about me, because I'm obsessed with myself. I am absolutely obsessed at what I don't have, what I need to have, what I should have, what you have that I want. You know, and I'm obsessed with making you love me, appreciate me, give me affection and approval, give me my sense of self so that I can be something, because without you, I'm nothing. And I spend my entire life living like this. Sometimes I still do. And this is the spiritual malady that I was talking about. And this is how I feel when I have no God. So when I'm making that third step, when I said that third step of prayer, Cass tricked me. Cass, my first sponsor. She tricked me. Because she had me say this. She got down on my knees and we said this prayer. We hold hands. You know, I had been saying it all along. I had gone through Back to Basics. I had done some 12-step work, but I hadn't been brought formally through the book from the very beginning to the end until I was 5 years sober. I'd done a lot of Back to Basics and a lot of workshops, and they're wonderful. They're great for early sobriety, or for your first introduction to the steps. But I find that working with a sponsor on a deeper level is great. They're no substitute. I guess I'm just trying to say that workshops are no substitute for good sponsorship. Sorry. My little plug there, my little opinion. And of course, the opinions of the speaker are not that of AA. So I had been doing these workshops and going through the steps, but having no direction on like the daily part of my life. I had a fellowship sponsor who hadn't really been working the steps that I was bouncing stuff off of, but I really didn't. I was rudderless, and so I had this sponsor, Cass, and she was wonderful. She saved my life, and she sat me down at 5 years sober, and you know, we said the third step prayer, and you know, it was the first time that I had said it with another person in the room. I had always done my third step prayer either in a group, like where no one heard me. I was not accountable to anybody. See, when I said that Thursday prayer, I made a contract with God and my sponsor. I made a contract with my God and my sponsor. When I sit down or kneel down and I say that prayer in front of somebody else, I'm accountable to that person. They know that now I'm asking God to fix me so I can serve Him and not me in my comfort and my feelings and what makes Carrie feel good. And see, now my sponsor witnessed this. Now it's a binding contract. It's not only just between me and God. It's between me, God, and someone else. And so when I said this prayer, she tricked me. And I wrote my inventory. And I loved it. I mean, I love the four-step. I really do. I've gotten so many benefits through four and five. I'm an admitted four-step junkie. I'm now a 12-step junkie. I'm more of a 12-step junkie today than I was a four-step junkie. I am a four-step junkie, but I was a four-step junkie for a really long time. And I love to analyze. I'm, like, so bad. You know, I told you I'm obsessed with myself, so let me write lots of inventory about me. So I wrote this inventory, and I had written a couple inventories before then, and I'd fifth-stepped it with a friend. Like, we basically swapped fifth steps at the same time, you know, and we both were kind of stumbling through it together, and she was wonderful. She helped me out a lot. But when I did this fifth step with Cass, I mean, Cass had my number, man. She had a daughter my age. She sponsored, you know, I don't know how many women this woman has sponsored over the years. You know, she had my number. She did. And so I started, like, reading off these resentments, like, you know, my resentment with my parents, you know, because, like, you know, oh God, you know, John got to do heroin for 10 years and didn't get sent to rehab, and I got sent to rehab and punished and kicked out, the doors locked on me and arrested, and we didn't do that to him. That's not fair. Of course, John was a smarter person than I am, because John would do it quietly. I was the one to get drunk and throw up in the living room and then fist fight with my father. This is me. You know, I have a mouth. I don't shut up. So, you know, like, I was not the quiet, like, let me just drink in the corner sort of drinker. I was more like a troublemaker, and I still am. So anyway, and so I, you know, I came to her with this inventory and all the things that everybody did to me. And I loved it because she helped me to see the truth. I mean, she really did. She served my butt up on a silver platter. She just, I mean, like, I told so many lies in my second column I never knew. I mean, I loved it. I was like, my dad was never there for me. He always hit me, you know. And Cass was like, so your dad died? I'm like, no. She's like, well, you know, what do you mean he was never there for you? You know, is he in another country? Did you never talk to him? I'm like, no. She's like, what was it? He didn't give me the attention that I wanted. Oh, so there we go. There's lie number one. You know, or he always hit me. And, of course, my dad was, I actually... You know, the reason why I, you know, for many years was extraordinarily resentful is because I experienced quite a bit of physical and sexual abuse as a child. I had a very, very loving parents, but my dad had a really, really bad temper. And he wasn't above to beating the living hell out of you every once in a while. And you know, the sexual abuse, and then, of course, you know, the rapes when I was drinking. So I was a real mess when I got sober, and I was a real mess at 5 years sober when Cass was working with me. And, she helped me. She helped me to see the lies. She helped me to see how I built so many walls and how I made everybody else my God but God. You know, at 5 years sober, I was still dependent upon how you thought of me. And everything that I was because you told me so. You know, and if you weren't there to tell me who I was, then I was nothing. You know, and I live like that. And, you know, and she showed me the light with that. And she, you know, when I did my fear inventory, and she, I was so afraid. I mean, I must have had like 150 fears, like lists and lists of all these fears and nuances. And I mean, I just was an absolute terrified mess, you know. And I thought it was because I was antisocial, that I was very intelligent, and that I was sarcastic, and I was just wittier than you guys. And that's why, you know, like, I was so withdrawn, and I had all these walls, and, you know, why I'd sit in my head and, you know, critique you, you know, because you're just not as quick on the uptake as I am, you know. And I lived with this absolute sense of inferiority, yet a desperate need to feel superior for many years. And so, you know, doing a fear inventory taught me just how absolutely afraid I really was. And that, you know, the Big Book talks about fear as a corrosive threat. And it says that it runs through our lives. And it also classes fear with stealing. And at first, like when I read that, I was like, okay, so Bill classes fear with stealing. Why? And so the first explanation I got was that fear was a conscious decision. And that's a good explanation, but I don't agree with that. What I believe, the reason why I believe that Bill classes fear with stealing is because when I'm afraid, I steal from you. I may not steal your money, but I steal your security. See, when I'm afraid, I do some backwards stuff. I'm the type of person, if I'm afraid, I will, if I'm cornered, if I'm threatened in any way, I will come out swinging. But you won't know I'm swinging. You'll be having a conversation with me, and you, my voice is very calm. I'm very monotone. And I'll talk to you in such a snide, superior, nasty, condescending, stinging way that you'd walk away from a conversation with me, couldn't put your finger on what it was that I said, but feel like I cut you off at the knees. And I thought that that was perfectly okay, because I didn't yell at you. I didn't call you a four-letter word, so that's good in my book. And so for me, and this is just for me, fear is classed with stealing because I steal your security when I'm afraid. I will do anything in order to avoid having what it is that I'm afraid of happen. I will manipulate, I will lie, I will cut you up, I will chew you up, I will spit you out, I will run you over with a lawnmower if I have to. You know, and so that's why I think Bill classes fear with stealing. So doing inventory, I mean, it taught me that. And of course, the sex inventory, well, I told you a little bit about it. It was pretty crazy. I wrote this sex ideal, and not a lot of people from the podium talk about the sex ideal, and I love to talk about it because what I thought the sex ideal was for years was, I make a list, and you need to be this. I got a list of demands. It was like I had a hostage, and I'm negotiating, you know. And so I used to write these sex ideals, and I'd come home, and I'm like, you're not living up to this one, and this one, and this one. I think I have room to be resentful for like a week. And what I love that Cass taught me, she taught me that, that if I have a sex ideal, it's what I want to be in the relationship. See, a sex ideal isn't a list of demands for those about me. It is my ideal for who I want to be in my relationships. And that doesn't, see, that includes sex, but I actually take my sex ideal, and if I take just the romantic element out of it, just take it out, there's a bare bones instruction for friendship too. You know, and I find that that if I'm all the things that are in my sex ideal, in my friendship relationships, I tend to not get in trouble. And I love that. I mean, if I hadn't, because the thing is, I knew after writing inventory and doing a fifth step what not to do. I mean, dude, everything I had done up until that point, just don't do that anymore. But I had no clue on what to do. Like, how do I not kick you in the balls when you piss me off? How do I not curse at you? How do I not, like jab at you? I love it. I call it verbal. Verbal pin. I just jab you with a little pin. You don't even know I did it until you're bleeding. You're wondering why. Like, how do I not do that stuff? How do I pause when agitated or doubtful? You know? And I love that the big book, and it's funny because I was thinking about that. I was like, you know, the 10-step talks about a vision for God's will for us. And I'm like, well, where the hell is this vision? All right, I'm supposed to have this vision of what God's will is for me. All I know is what not to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know, you know, how do I handle these situations? I'm going to handle situations that used to baffle me. I mean, damn it, I keep screwing up and having to make amends for it, you know. And I was reading the big book one day because I was tired of making amends. I was tired of doing those 10-step amends, you know. You know those ones I'm talking about when you open your big fat mouth? Well, I love it. My sponsor Debbie now says to me, she said, you know, she used to say, and this was her line, she was like, Carrie, you were right until you opened your mouth. You know, basically, like, that person was a schmuck, but until you started to open your mouth and tell them they were a schmuck, you were right. But now you're wrong, gotta make amends. So you know, it talks about that vision. And I think for me, the sex ideal is part of what that vision for God's will is for us. And later on, you know, if you read the book, and I did, and I looked at it from the perspective of the 10th step of what Bill is trying to tell me I should be, what a sober life, living on spiritual terms should look like. And it's in there. It's all over there. Fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and others. The very lives of ex-problem drinkers is dependent upon our helping others. You know, simply, you know, patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. It's all through that book. If you read to the wives and the family afterward, there are thousands of instructions, not thousands, but hundreds of instructions on exactly how to handle situations, how to carry the vision of God's will, and carry the visions of God's will in our lives. And it's all over there. But see, I wasn't reading it for instructions on what to do. I was trying to figure out what not to do. And when I went back and I looked at what Bill was instructing me to do in my life, I learned a lot more. You know, so I had this, you know, I did this fifth step, and I've done countless inventories. It's in the teens, and I've done lots of fifth steps. I've done them every way you could possibly imagine. My favorite one is the one that I did a fifth step. I did a long form, which is a really long, arduous, anal retentive inventory that unless you're one who feel like you've been roto-rooted, you probably don't want to do, but I had a lot of fun with it. I get bored with inventory because I know how to manipulate it. So, like, you know, every once in a while, somebody's got an interesting inventory. I'm like, let me try that. And so it's this long inventory. It had, like, you know, extended third column. You wrote out your third column. And the fourth column was, like, where you were selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened in every single one of the third column, you know, areas. And, you know, your self-esteem, your pride, your pocketbook, ambitions, personal relations, sex relations. So, like, your fourth column ends up being, like, 35 questions. Yeah, that's the inventory I gave you last night, dude. So this is the, I did that, and I actually did a fifth step with a bunch of women who, a couple of them were my sponsees, one of them wasn't. They all had a year or less, and they all had just gone through inventory and were in their amends. So I'm 7 years sober. I'm with my sponsees and some of my young friends who are new to the program, new to the book, having had their first brush with God, on fire with God, and then I'm like the old war-weary veteran with my petty nonsense coming to do this inventory. It was so humbling, because they're all like, well, why don't you just do this? I mean, and this is, they were like, they had like a checklist, man. They were like, oh, I'm going to get her an inventory. You know, and they got me, and I loved it, because I walked out of there, and like the whole time I wanted to scream, when you're 7 years sober, you'll be as crazy as me too, I swear to God. But I had to sit there quietly, sitting in my hands, and say, yes, that's possible. Yes, that's possible. And I walked out of there, and I came home, and I took my quiet hour, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was like, I'm going to fall asleep. So I get a bubble bath, and I put a bunch of candles, and I sat in the tub, and I took my fourth step, and I took my big book, and I just sat there, and I looked it over, I asked myself all the questions, and I'm sitting there, and I felt this, I was just like, I need to have God, and I need God now, and I need God everywhere. I can't just have God take care of, like, bits and pieces of my life. And this is where my second step became real. I needed God in all the aspects of my life, because at 7 years of sobriety, with as much step work as I had, with as much experience as I had working the steps, 12-stepping, sponsoring, you know, 10 and 15 women at a time, doing all this work, speaking everywhere, doing big book studies, I still was a effing mess. And I knew that no amount of knowledge or experience with the steps was going to get me better except for a direct connection with God, and I needed it then. I wrote this long, arduous letter to God, just asking, inviting God in, and asking God to take care of these things, to come into my life in every place. And I put it in my God box. I have a God box. I'm hokey. And I went to bed that night, and I woke up, and things were different. I was different. And I've had that happen on more than one occasion after a fist step, but that was a really profound one. I had one happen after I did a fist step with a guy. After all my hatred and all my experience, having, you know, as much violence as I experienced at the hands of men, I needed, and this was just my experience, I needed to go to somebody that I was not sexually attracted to and do a fist step with him so that I could be vulnerable for the first time in my life. See, I can be vulnerable to you if I think I'm going to get something for you or if I'm attracted to you, because then it's okay because I have an angle. But if I'm going to be vulnerable to you and have no hook, no angle, that's really hard. There's no leverage there. There's no room. And I did this, and it was an amazing experience. And so, you know, the fifth step, the fourth step, I mean, I'm a huge fan. So then, you know, and of course that letter that I wrote and that experience I have was my seventh step. You know, it was this absolute surrender. See, in the second step, it tells us that the God idea worked and our ideas didn't. By the time I got to the seventh step, I understood on the deepest levels of my heart and soul that the God idea works and my ideas don't. that the way that I had been running my life, I was absolutely convinced, without beyond a shadow of a doubt, that what I had been doing, the way I had been living, was getting me nowhere. And, you know, I made this list, and I went out to make amends, and I have some awesome amends stories, some absolutely wonderful healing amends stories, and I tell them all the time, so I'm not going to tell them tonight. You know, I have an awesome healing amends story with my mother. God came into my life and healed the relationship with my mother in such a way that I haven't yelled at that woman in years. I haven't raised my voice. She's watching my children. She is more proud of me today than she could ever possibly have dreamed and has told me so on a number of occasions. And I was the one who got pregnant at 18 years old that she told me that I was going to be nothing and that I was a whore. And now when she and my father fight, she calls me up to talk. You know, she actually relies on me to help her. And this is an amazing thing. This is not the girl that she knew years ago. And it was because of the ninth step. I made amends to my brother, and he beat the living hell out of me for years. I mean, really physically abused me. I have, like, scars all over my body from my brother. And I went and made amends to him for resenting him for years. And that was extraordinarily healing. I have hundreds of stories. I mean, if you stay sober long enough and you do as many crazy things that I've done, drunk or sober, you have a lot of amends and a lot of healing amends stories. You know, and there's nothing like the process of amends. But, you know, I tell these amends stories, and I find that, like, they're always great. They're great. They're anecdotes. They're awesome. But you know what? Go out and make amends and find out for yourself. Find out. I love it. I have had people, and I've gotten irate at times. I've had people say, well, I don't get how amends can be so transforming. I don't get what the point is. And I'm like, well, you haven't made them. Make them and find out. Make them. Be humble. Own your faults. Stare somebody in the face. Don't. I love the book. It says that we're not servile or scraping. We stand at our own feet. We're children of God. Stand in that attitude before another human being and admit your faults. And it is the most freeing thing, because I labored under the absolute yoke of being right. I needed to be right. I couldn't be wrong, and I couldn't let you see a flaw or a fault. And I needed to have my ass covered at every turn. And by the process of just going before another human being and admitting what I refused to admit for years was an awesome experience. So now I'm much more comfortable with being wrong. I'm much more comfortable with being vulnerable. I'm much more comfortable with being human and fallible today. And it was because of that amends process. So that's my amends story. Very sweet and very quick. So 10 and 11. 10, pause when agitated or doubtful. I love it. People always say to me that there's no instructions for the seventh step. I said, yeah, that's because they're in the 10th step. Think about that. You know, when we ask God to come in, right? We say, my creator, I'm willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I'm not going to evaluate what's good or bad about me, right? I want you to have all of me, good and bad. You know, and then, well, what do I do after that? Well, what do I do about these character defects? Well, I pause when agitated or doubtful. I watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And when they crop up, I ask God to remove them. I ask for direction. I don't do this every moment of every day. I have lots of 10-step amends that I have to make on a regular basis. But the point is that I live and placed in a position today. I have my sponsor. It's really funny. One of my sponsees, she talked to me this weekend, and she was like, now I know why you have pause written all over your house. I get it. I've been sponsoring her for like a year and a half. She finally figured it out that it was the 10-step, because I have pause. I have watch written all over my house, because I need to be reminded to pause when agitated or doubtful. I need to pause when I'm not sure what to do. I need to not do anything if I don't know what to do. I need to ask for direction. You know, I love it. I do get direction. I get it all the time. I get the little thoughts in my back of the head, in the back of my head. Sometimes I get nothing. And when I get nothing, that means something to me. It means that I shouldn't be doing that. You know, Jay was saying that last night, and I agree 100%. It means if I get nothing, it means that I probably shouldn't be doing it. You know, because you get that feeling in the bottom of your in your stomach, that like when you should be doing something. I know that when there's an action that I need to take to serve God, I'm propelled into it. When there's an action that I need to take that serves me, it's like walking through molasses. you know, everything, tree branches, everything falls. You know, they can watch those, like, you know, you see a car speeding through the woods, the trees are falling, boulders are rolling. That's me when I'm my life is run on self-will, and I'm dodging, just trying to get to the other side, to get what I think I want, which is probably what I don't need anyway, and I step on everybody's toes in the process. You know, and so I find that, you know, when I'm living in that basis, when I'm asking for direction, when I pause, when I agitate a doubtful, when I do my morning meditation, when I live in conscious connection with my Creator, I find that that doesn't happen so often. I have days of that. I have moments of that. I have hours. And sometimes I'll even have a week where I'm not doing all that great. But my not great is so much better than where it was. You know, and I realize I'm aware of the mistakes that I make. I know when I fall short. You know, so, you know, but I find that also that all this stuff brings me to what the whole point of this whole thing is the 12th step. You know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all my affairs. And I've had extraordinary experiences with that. I've had absolutely revolutionary experiences with that. I sponsored so many women, and I've had, you know, I was an absolute wreck who couldn't stay out of 4-point restraints when I was drinking, okay? I couldn't not hit you if you pissed me off. I couldn't not drink. I'm trying to die more times than I can count. And I can actually, by the grace of God, by what God has done for me in my life, by the experiences that I've had with the 12 steps, I can actually work with other women and help them to see the truth about themselves, the same way Cass and Debbie and all the wonderful women that have come into my life have done for me. You know, and that's an amazing experience when the light goes on and when they understand. You know, it's one thing to read the book and comprehend it. It's an entirely different thing to understand and experience it. And I've had the privilege of being able to do that. And I've had the privilege of hearing fifth steps that were extraordinarily painful for other people to give and be able to be that loving hand of God and listen and not judge. You know, I work on my straight face. You know, I do. You know, when you hear fifth steps and you hear enough of them, you gotta have the straight face. You gotta not react. You gotta have the really. And I work on it because you know you hear enough fifth steps, you will hear things that your first reaction is like, why? you know, and I've had a great experience with that. When you know, and practicing the principles in all my affairs. I mean, I have two loving children. I have a husband that I love. I have wonderful friends that I can be vulnerable and close to. I can share things with people that I never could share before. You know, and I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, in the past week, I was thinking, well, I have to speak, and what am I going to talk about? You guys know me. You know, like, I don't want to give, like, what you guys always hear because you guys know me. And I'm like, you know, what's one thing that can encapsulate the 12th step that doesn't have to do with sponsorship, but has to do with practicing the principles in all my affairs. And I thought of an incident that happened last winter. And I think this is a good way to round it up and a good example. Last December, I was Christmas shopping for for my kids. And so I had my husband and I went to the mall, and we left my children with my mother. And I was Christmas shopping, and I was in the mall, and I was walking into this store. His name is Spencer's. My son has had an obsession at the time with a rubber chicken. He wanted a rubber chicken really bad. I don't know why. So I was going to buy him this rubber chicken and put it in his Christmas stocking. And I'm walking into the store, and I'm the doorway is here. I'm right here. And I hear bang. I heard glass crash. I saw some shelves being knocked over, and two people ran out, and one of them knocked me into the side of the wall. And I was stunned for a minute, and I'm thinking, oh, they're stealing. You know, they're doing, I don't know if you guys have ever done that, like, where you go in snatch and grab, and, like, five people descend on the store, shove your pockets full, and everybody runs out. They can't catch you all. And so I figured, okay, this is what they're doing. And I walk in, and I get into the doorway, and I hear somebody screaming, he's shot, he's shot. You know, I saw it happen, but I didn't register. I didn't see. The gun was down here, so I didn't see it, but I had seen the guy fall down, and I just assumed he pushed him out of the way. And so somebody's screaming, he's shot, you know, does anybody have any medical training? Is there a nurse or a doctor here? So I go running back, and my first instinct of, how can I be of service? How can I help in this situation? I didn't even think. Let me put it that way. I didn't even think, how can I help? I just ran back. And one of the store attendants said, are you a nurse or a doctor? I said, no, I'm a mom. And Any good mom has read more than one. I mean, like, when I had my daughter, because I was 19 by a month when I had her, I read every first aid book I can get my hands on. I read the Red Cross. I read everything, because you never know. You know, and of course, like, when your child is broken, you know, laying there with a broken leg or a gash in their head or they're choking on poison, you really don't want to be looking it up and going, oh, okay, now, you know. So I a little obsessively, because that's the way I do things, obsessively read first aid books. In fact, I was kind of a morbid child who read medical books as a child. And I also read first aid books and was, like, fascinated by amputations and tourniquets and stuff. My sister was a nurse, so, like, I just, all her books I read. So, I, you know, it was natural when I had a kid that I was going to read all this stuff, you know. So here I am, like, this little mom, you know, this little soccer mom, like, you know, running back, and this guy's laying on the floor and he's shot, and everybody's just standing there. And so I took off my sweater, and I put it over the gunshot wound, and I held it there, and I'm talking to him, and I'm trying to see, like, if he can move his legs, because he was shot in the back, and you don't know if they're paralyzed, and you don't know how close, whether the bullet's, like, on their spine, so you need to know whether, you know, whether they can move their hands and their feet, that, to know how much pressure you're going to put on the wound. And I'm doing this, and I'm talking to him, and it's Christmas, and there's traffic everywhere, and no one can get into the, I mean, it took us 45 minutes for us to get into the parking lot at Willowbrook Mall, and the EMTs are not coming, and there's this guy, we had them on the phone with 911, and there's this guy, he's laying on the floor, and he's bleeding, and he's shot, and we're there for, it's like, I don't know how long it took, I can't even tell you, you know, and, you know, I'm sitting there, and I'm talking to him, and I'm calming him down, and whatever. And finally, after, like, an indeterminable, you know, stretch of time, you know, the EMTs come, and I get up, and I walk out, and I leave my sweater covered in blood, and I, you know, I go wash my hands, and I go home. And it didn't occur to me until, like, afterwards that I didn't even think for once about my safety. I didn't think about, you know, well, you know, I had just bought a pair of diamond earrings for my sister-in-law with, like, a lot of money, and I just threw them down on the floor and didn't think about my purchases or whether or not they were going to get lost or what I was going to do, or, you know, I didn't think about the fact that my head got knocked into the window. You know, I was a little hurt and didn't realize it until the next day. You know, I just helped, because that's what we do. That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we're taught to do. We're taught to be of service. My very life as an ex-problem drinker is how I can help meet others' needs. You know, and it was at that moment, you know, that I realized that my life was no longer about me. It wasn't about my, and people afterwards were like, well, you got his blood on you. What if you got AIDS? And I was like, I'm going to let him bleed to death because of the possibility that I might contract a virus. I'm just going to let him bleed. I couldn't do that, and I didn't even think of that. Later I got tested, by the way. But the point is that I didn't think about me, and that's not because of me. That's not because I'm special. It's because this is what this program has taught me. It taught me that at times of trouble, at times of crisis, and at times when times are good, that my life isn't about me. My life is about serving you. And if I can live like that, I can be happy. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Carrie, very much. It's always good to hear your experience, strength, and hope. And since this was a special month, I'd like to thank all the speakers that we had this month. The first week, we kicked it off with Kathy. Then the following week was Adam, Carrie's husband. Then we had Dave with the third week, and last week was Jameson, and then, of course, this week we had Carrie. So if we could just give a round of applause. At our business meeting last week, we decided to do this every year, to somewhere in the fall, to divert from our normal format, and for about 4 or 5 weeks, to have home group speakers do the entire month. And